Is this house a good price compared to others in the area? Are prices going up or down? If I don't make an offer right this very moment, will I miss my chance? These are just some of the questions a home buyer might ask. And these are the sorts of questions an agent who is a Realtor can help answer. Because Realtors have the expertise, data, and access to specialty training to help you navigate the process of buying a home. They provide support, guidance, and have your back every step of the way. That's what Realtors do, because that's who we are. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors.
Crooked Conversations is brought to you by HBO's Succession.
Ooh. HBO's Succession.
Now is the perfect time to catch up on the hit HBO series, Succession. Watch the show critics are calling deliciously savage and a damn good series that only gets better. Mm. Set in the boardrooms and penthouse apartments of New York City and beyond, Succession explores power, money, and the family in the cutthroat corporate world.
My ears are burning.
There's even a political storyline that is almost as crazy as what's happening in the real world. We'll be the judge of that. I just caught up on Succession last night. I watched last night's new episode. I watched the episode before that because I had fallen asleep before it was on. It's so good. I love Succession.
I really like it. Brian Cox is so good in the show as the patriarch.
Oh, yeah.
I really like him.
He's
always so good. And I like how low-key he's playing it,
yeah.
You know, but intimidating.
Close to the vest.
All three of the children are excellent, too.
Yeah, I like seeing Kieran Culkin.
Yeah, they all suck in different ways.
Kieran Culkin, he made it through that child star ringer, you know, came out the other side. Good for him. He's great.
From Adam McKay, director of The Big Short, and In the Loop writer Jesse Armstrong, Succession airs Sunday nights at 10 p.m., and you can watch the first five episodes right now on streaming and on-demand platforms, only on HBO.
Hi, y'all. This is Julissa Arce, one of your favorite Crooked Conversations hosts, as I've been told. I am really excited about this week's conversation with Yosimar Reyes, who is a nationally acclaimed poet, educator, and performance artist. We had a really amazing heart-to-heart about what it means to be an American as two Mexican immigrants, about American identity this 4th of July, what we're choosing to celebrate as Americans, and just about the overall meaning of what home is and where home is for us. I hope you enjoy. I read something on your website today that resonated like really, really deeply in my soul. And it said, "It is this skin that tells people I am not from here, that I come from a place closer to the sun." So tell us, where are you from and who is Yosimar?
Yeah, so I'm originally from the beautiful state of Guerrero, Mexico, but I migrated here when I was 3 years old, and I think for the longest time I've had this, I think as like a lot of immigrant kids, this idea of like, my home is still in Mexico, even though I've been here forever. Yeah. So I grew up in Eastside San Jose in a really abundant community of people. And I think for me, like, I'm a poet, a writer, and in my work, what I try to do is really capture the sense of community, and specifically a community that a lot of times people feel are not strategists or thinkers or creators, and that being undocumented people. And so for me, in the work that I do, I try to highlight that, how resilient and how we create our own mechanisms of survival, and it's always been like that.
You said you're from Guerrero, Mexico, and a lot of the interviews that you do and the speaking that I've heard you in, you always talk about being from Guerrero, and I find it interesting that you say you're from Guerrero and not the city that you're from, because I'm from Guerrero too, but I always say I'm from Taxco, Guerrero, and I'm wondering, why is that? What city are you from, and why don't you sort of say the city you're from?
Yeah, so I'm from a place called Atoyac de Álvarez Guerrero, which is not that far. I think it's like five hours from Taxco. I don't know. Guerrero's real big.
Yeah,
but I think for me in general, I think it's just people don't really have an understanding of the state in general. So a lot of people are like, oh, you're from Mexico. And people assume that you are from like the northern states or whatever. So like, no, I'm from the south. Like, it's really down there. And for me, like, I don't know. I really love the word Guerrero because I think it really symbolizes, you know, the
people. Tell us what Guerrero translates.
So Guerrero translates to warrior. So I really love that. And I love that the R's are really hard to roll.
So like only we can say
yes,
it, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
You mentioned being undocumented. Mm-hmm. So when did you find out that you were undocumented? When did that become like a thing for you?
So I actually write about this a lot. It's like I've always known I was undocumented. I kind of had those parents that didn't really shun you away from trauma. I tell a joke a lot of times that one time I told my grandma, like, when I grow up, I want to be the president of the United States of America. And she responded like, well, that's cute, but you don't have papers or learn construction like your uncles. So I kind of always knew, right? But I think I was always instilled with the idea that, you know, just work super, super hard and things are going to pay off and things are going to land into place. And eventually, with or without papers, you're going to end up being okay.
Yeah, I remember my mom had this idea that living in America, you needed to do two things to be successful. You needed to work hard and you needed to stay out of trouble. And if you did those two things, it was like a formula that couldn't be broken. And then I found out I was undocumented when I was like 14. And so I didn't know until I was like 14 that I was like, oh, I don't have papers. And that means that this formula might not work for me. I mean, eventually things did work out. But I do think that a lot of immigrants come here believing that in America, all you need to do is work hard. And I think that our parents' generations really believes that. And I'm wondering whether you think that's true. Is it true that you can come to America, work really hard, and that's the only thing you need to do?
I think it's very difficult. That formula is very difficult. And I think sometimes I was very frustrated because I think that kind of created this idea that you shouldn't ask for help, meaning that you don't ask questions, you don't, you know, all these ideas that I'm like, you're just making life a lot more complicated when, right? But I think for me it was interesting because I grew up in an apartment complex in Eastside San Jose, and everybody that I knew growing up was undocumented. So I already grew up with this huge community of folks that kind of had different ways. Like people knew how to, what companies would hire you without documents. People knew where you could get some documents. Like it was just like it was this intricate mechanisms that we already knew, you know. And also because I was young and I spoke English, like I was, you know, I think it's a very immigrant kid. Like you already learn how to type people's resumes and how to like fill out applications, how to lie on the phone that you were like their previous employer. Like all these things that kind of, I think for me, created a confidence that because I already learned English, I was already ahead of the game.
Yeah.
So I think that's what that taught me. And I think for me, I always say that I've been lucky in the things that I've been able to achieve, because as an undocumented person, there's certain opportunities that are not granted to you. But I feel like that even that is imposter syndrome, and that I'm always saying, oh, no, I'm just lucky. I'm like lucky. Like someone told me that I need to stop saying that, because actually luck is just when preparation meets opportunity. Yep. And it just so happens that I was prepared to take on that opportunity. And therefore I've been landed doing these really amazing projects that I didn't ever think I would be able to do.
So. Yeah. Well, it's funny because when we were talking outside, that sort of imposter syndrome, and I was telling you, I've written two books. One of them became a Washington Post bestseller. The second one comes out later in the fall. And just the other day, I Googled my name because I was looking for a link for something I needed to share. And Google like makes this little biography for you. And so mine said like Julissa Arce, writer. And I was like, oh shit, Google says I'm a writer. Like that must really mean I'm a writer now. But it sort of goes to that of like, I should already feel like a writer. But I don't sometimes, even though I am. So I totally understand that feeling of like, you do feel lucky, and you feel, at least I felt like, because I was undocumented, I was just lucky to get whatever I had versus like asking for more. But you said something about speaking English, and that because you spoke English, you felt like you were already ahead of the game. Were there things that, well, I guess let me ask you this first. Have you felt American? Do you feel like you're American?
So that's an interesting question. I think for so long, as an undocumented person who's kind of been involved in immigration and all this stuff, I've always felt like rejected or never felt part of anything. And for the longest time, I would always claim, no, I'm Mexican. I'm straight up from Guerrero. I'm out here in these streets, you know, wearing my little Mexican flag. But then I got the opportunity to return to Mexico on advance parole. And for people to know advance parole, it's basically, right, a permission that I got from DACA that allowed me to go back to Mexico for educational purpose, humanitarian purposes, or for employment. I went on educational purposes. I got accepted to a program.
And sorry, I just want to say this really quick, that even though people can apply for DACA right now, well, we know that new applications aren't being accepted, and also advanced parole is not allowed right now. So no. I just wanted to say that, because it's not something that people can do anymore.
They can't do that anymore.
But tell us about the
experience. So I got a letter the year that they were campaigning for the president, and I got super hyped up. I'm like, oh my God, I haven't been to Mexico since I'm 23 years old. Like, it's been 25 years. Like, this is going to be super amazing. And then the president got elected. I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't go.
But you went.
I decided to go. Okay. I was like, I need to figure out the rest of my life. Like, I cannot be out here having this fear about eventually returning back to where I come from. Like, I need to investigate what psychological effects, you know, like, if I were to go back, like, how am I going to figure out how to rebuild? So I went back. And once I returned to Mexico, it was the first time I felt American. Because I'm looking around, and I just don't identify. Like, the culture is different. Like, I have a sense and understanding of certain things that I value, that I feel like, you know, I was, especially in the small city that we're from, I was like, yo, like, you know, like, where is, like, the critical queer theory here? You know, where is the feminist praxis here? Like, all these things that I was like, that I've learned to challenge within the United States. And also, I think a lot of the comforts that living in the United States grants you, right? Like, you can walk to a local Starbucks and steal their internet, you know? And I think for me, I started thinking of, like, does American mean to me living in this commodities? And is that really what I'm going to lose if I were to return back, you know? So it really helped me understand that. But I think that was the first time that I felt like I'm acting like a really snobby American, because I'm so used to certain things, you know, or things working in a certain protocol. So, yeah, and I found myself, I was like 3 weeks there. And I think by the end of the first week, I was like, I'm ready to go home. And home meaning here, Los Angeles, which was an interest. I haven't really written about it, but I'm like, yeah. And but then even then I started recognizing, like, yo, when I'm also being really critical of turn American, and when I'm really kind of pushing it away, I'm also kind of being disrespectful to the Americans that have shaped this country, right? I'm being disrespectful to people like Toni Morrison, James Baldwin, like all these writers and activists who have fought hard to be integrated, and who all these activists, you know, folks in the civil rights movement that have granted the freedoms that we have today, right? Like, the freedoms that we have today are because of people of color. Yeah. And so for me, it was like, if anything, I'm going to claim being American to be incorporated in that group. And being American for me is just holding the country, this country accountable to live up to its definition.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because I wonder, you know, like, for example, like, when we talk about American, like, even before I came to live in the U.S., I had an idea of who I thought Americans were. And a lot of those ideas came from, like, TV shows that I watched in Mexico that were American shows dubbed in Spanish. And it was like Dennis the Menace and Beverly Hills 90210, the original that had, like, no people of color in the show. So to me, an American was someone that was beautiful, that was rich, and that was white. And that's who I thought Americans were. And then when I came to live here, I moved to Texas, and in Texas, a lot of people looked like you and I, right? They were brown, they had black hair, they spoke Spanish, and that was what they considered to be, like, American culture. And I think that for me, at least, it's been this struggle of, like, I am American, but I almost have to redefine what it means to be an American, because a lot of people do think that, you know, if you are a white American and you feel like your family's been here for many, many, many generations, you don't still have this feeling of my home is back wherever my parents came from, right? Like, you view this as your home. And when you ask someone, like, where are you from? And they say Indiana, that's it. That's the end of the question. But like if somebody asks us where we're from, there's always that extra from question, like where are you from, you know? So what to you does it mean to be an American on 4th of July?
Well, I think for me, especially this year, I feel like this week, this whole month, I'm like, to be undocumented in this country is just, it's really tiring. Like, you wake up and then they're blaming you for something. I'm like, what did I do this time? I just woke up, you know, like, most people aren't up at this hour. What did I do? So it's just really, I think right now, it's just really hard. I think if anything, I've really tuned out, like especially my timeline of my Facebook is filled with all these things. And I'm like, wow, like I feel like if I'm feeling this, I'm just going to imagine someone that, you know, that's, you know, in another predicament, but still processing all this information. So I don't know. It's a very complicated thing. I know I'm definitely throwing a barbecue with my undocumented friends at my house. That's going to be cute. I think anytime I feel like one of my coping mechanisms that I've done lately is when anything really bad happens or something, a current event, you know, that I feel it's really monumental and it's affecting my friends. Like I feel better when we all come together and just laugh and enjoy these moments, you know, because I think everything in immigration shifts so rapidly and changes so fast that I think taking the moment to appreciate one another and like letting another undocumented person know, hey, I see you and I appreciate that you're still smiling and going to work. And I think you're super resilient, and take a moment to honor that. I think that's what I want to do a little bit more, because I feel like right now what we're doing a lot, I think a lot of times when we talk about undocumented people, we really focus on trying to convince citizens to vote. So we use our stories, the stories of undocumented people, to persuade citizens and create a moral crisis within the country, that oftentimes we forget that there's 11 million undocumented people in this country also consuming that media.
Yeah.
And nobody focuses on an undocumented audience or creating media that's reaffirming, that's inspirational, that's like, listen, that just happened, but look at this other undocumented person.
Yeah.
Look at Lulisa, who did this book, and, you know, I use them as examples to at least give you a little bit of hope in all this, everything that's dark. And so for me as a poet, as a writer, I want to be able to at least be that, you know, that little 3-minute video poem that's going to be like, oh, I feel a little better, you know?
Yeah.
Because I think it happens a lot. We're so caught up that we forget that also undocumented people are consuming this media.
Yeah, that's absolutely, absolutely true. We'll be back with more of this conversation with Yosimar Reyes.
Crooked Conversations is brought to you by Quip.
It's brought to you by Quip.
The truth is, most of us are brushing our teeth wrong, not for long enough, and forget to change our brush on time. That's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. So what makes Quip so different?
What makes Quip so different, John?
For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes.
What?
While still packing.
Packing what?
Just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth.
Oh, my goodness.
Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist recommended 2 minutes with you, guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides?
You dog.
Next, Quip subscription plans are for your health, not just convenience. They deliver
obviously.
New brush heads on a dentist recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5.
Those heads
free
come
shipping worldwide.
Like clockwork.
My God.
Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for
what
hygienic travel.
You're speaking so fast through the best parts.
Wherever you take your teeth, which is everywhere. Mm-hmm. With Quip, you don't have to worry about getting new brush heads or toothpaste. They're delivered right to your door.
We've
on
already covered
schedule
that.
So you replace your brush on time.
Heads you can set your watch to.
Better hygiene at an affordable price with the sleekest design you've ever seen for an electric toothbrush.
Yeah.
Just finally.
Very aerodynamic.
Everyone loves Quip.
Yeah.
They were on Oprah's O-List.
What list?
Power through a chime.
Name one of Time's best inventions and is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association.
Time magazine loved it.
Quip will even give you tips on oral care that you probably never
what
knew.
Well, I bet. I bet they got some ideas over there.
Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers.
What a party.
Every day.
That's a lot of people.
That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/cricketconvos. Spelled GETQUIP.com/cricketconvos. Cricket Conversations is brought to you by Finn. Finn is a high-quality on-demand assistant that handles the administrative aspects of life so you can focus on what matters most. Finn takes care of administrative tasks so you can make better use of your time and be more productive. What do you guys think about Finn?
Could I just be like, hey, Finn, make me a reservation at my favorite restaurant?
Yeah, you can. And you can say, Finn, tonight's the night that Ann and I are cooking Blue Apron again.
That felt like a dig.
Yeah. And Finn's like, hey, Tommy, I know you're getting married soon, but that doesn't mean romance is dead.
Hey,
you know, that's what Finn says to you.
Finn's like, hey, Tommy, hanging out with your dog on Friday night is not being social. Okay, get off the couch.
Hey,
take
Tommy,
off the sweatpants.
Hey, Tommy, it's Finn. I noticed that you haven't done anything with another human being all weekend
in 2018.
Get a little concerned.
Finn, block out some more hours to do these ads because they take a long time. There's just not enough hours in the day to get all my tasks done. My options were to continue doing things myself, how I've been doing them, but that's when I discovered Finn. And like the best assistants, Finn knows your preferences, remembers the people you interact with, and integrates with your email and calendar. They make calls, send emails on your behalf, pay bills, remember important dates, and automatically get things done for you. I'm sending all my emails with Finn from now on.
Me too.
You guys will never know it's me.
Back
me.
Off.
If you're someone who doesn't have 40 hours of work for an assistant every week, here's the best part. Finn is always available, on demand, and you only pay for what you use. Once you try Finn, you're going to love it as much as we do. And as a listener of Crooked Conversations, we've arranged for all of you to try Finn for free. You get free Finn. You get free Finn.
Yeah.
You get free Finn.
And you.
Just use our link, finn.com/cricketconvos. That's finn.com/cricketconvos to try Finn for free. finn.com/cricketconvos.
It's one thing falling in love with a house, picturing yourself moving in and calling it home, and quite another navigating the world of price negotiating, mortgage lenders, and finding the budget that works best for you. An agent who's a realtor can make understanding that world easier. Realtors have the expertise, access to proprietary data, and tools to help you get from imagining living somewhere to actually doing it. That's the kind of help we can provide. Because that's who we are. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors.
It's interesting to me when I hear you sort of talk about all your undocumented friends and thinking about an undocumented audience, because for a long time, I didn't know other undocumented people. Like, I didn't grow up around undocumented people, or at least like undocumented people who were out about being undocumented, right? Like, I didn't even tell my closest friends that I was undocumented. It's something that I was ashamed of and that I tried to hide. And I tried to do so many things so that I would be considered American, right? And like some of the things that I thought I had to do to be considered American were like speak good English and get good grades in school. And, you know, in middle school and in high school, like I wanted to be in the drama club, but like the cool kids were cheerleaders and they played sports. And so I became a cheerleader and I played sports. And so then I was like, okay, like now I'm American. Like now I'm assimilating to this American culture. And then I realized like, well, what I'm really assimilating to is like white American culture, right? Not because like American culture in Texas, for example, was like a mix of cowboy and Mexican, right? Like it was infused with Mexican flavors from like the food to the music to like the people. And then so hearing you talk about all of your undocumented friends and I think that's like a beautiful thing. And like, I wish I had had that, you know, I wish I didn't have to feel like I had to give up so much of my identity to become American. Are there things that you feel like you've compromised in your own identity to feel more American? Or is that even a thing for like, do you even like is, yeah, I'm just wondering, like, are there things you've done in the past that you feel like you had to do to be considered American? And are there things you do now? Or is American not even the goal anymore?
I think for me, it's like redefining it and really looking at, you know, I've never really encountered that. I think for me, it was like I grew up in this community. You know, honestly, I grew up in Eastside San Jose. We didn't see white folks until we went to like an art museum on a field trip or something, but it wasn't like something immediate within our community, right? And I think for me, if anything, I love books. I love reading. I was a huge reader. So for me, it was like, I want to read all these novels. And I remember reading John Updike, reading Virginia Woolf, all these authors that were like, people would tell me like, if you read them, they're going to make you super, super smart. Right. And in high school, I read all that. But then I started wondering, like, listen, this is not relating to me, you know. I love Mrs. Dalloway, but, you know, I don't know, you know, about biscuits and tea and all that stuff. Like, I want to read something that's more about me. So then, that's when I started reading people of color, Alice Walker, James Baldwin, all these authors that I'm like, okay, I can relate to this stuff. But I think because I had that, those formative years, I had that kind of literature, I've always known, like, listen, they're redefining what that means and allowing more space for us to exist. And then when I started writing my own work, I was like, listen, I want to write about immigrants, specifically undocumented immigrants, but I want to write about undocumented immigrants, not as undocumented being an identity, because I always tell people it's not. It's a social condition. It's like poverty. It's something that's created. There's nothing in my body that's undocumented. I'm just as able to do something than anybody else. The only difference is that you have someone has a social and I don't. Other than that, I'm just as capable. I have the same abilities. So for me, like, I want to write about that. And I also want to write undocumented people from this dignified perspective, because my grandma always taught me about that. She was like, listen, my grandma raised me out of recycling bottles and cans. Like, she was that lady in that neighborhood going through people's trash cans, recycling bottles and cans. But she always told me, like, listen, don't ever let people look down upon you, because that robs you of your agency and that robs you of your power and it makes them feel superior to you. So I've always had that kind of attitude, which I feel is going to get me in trouble one day. Because, you know, people don't like dignified immigrants. Like, it's a really bad thing to be like, I don't need, you know, like, to be really, it sounds really disrespectful. But for me,
but you were talking about dignified undocumented people or just dignified immigrants. And I love that, right? Because a lot of times, like, when I go on Fox News and I mean,
we can. Yeah, girl, I've been seeing you. Like, oh, she's going in. Yes.
Yeah. The number one thing that I get comments is that I am so ungrateful, that I should be so grateful for what America has given me. And sometimes, you know, I'll respond to some things, just because I'm human. And I'm like, what do you mean I'm ungrateful? Like, I don't have to. I think that one of the things about 4th of July that I think about very often is we're celebrating the independence of America. And what the founding fathers did is they dissented from the crown, right? They rebelled. And I feel like the crowns of today are racism, systematic oppression of people. And to be American, to me, is to dissent and to rebel and to stand up to injustices. And, like, that's what I want to do this 4th of July. Like, I want to take a flag and I want to wave it and I want to chant USA. And I don't want it to mean, because I feel like the right wing has sort of, like, co-opted American symbols and, like, the flag itself and patriotism itself. And, like, when you hear chants of USA or you see someone wrapped around in an American flag, like, you get certain ideas about what that person.
You get triggered. I'm like, yeah, oh, awkward.
Exactly. When it, you know, like, I'm like, that is my flag too. Like, you know, like, but the thing is, even being an American citizen now, like, all of these things that you're saying, I still feel very deeply in my heart because I was undocumented for 15 years. And, like, that doesn't go, like, that trauma doesn't go away, like, just because I have a U.S. passport now, you know? So I love that, dignified immigrant.
Yeah, I think, like, that's the difference. I think I'm not ungrateful, but at the same time, I'm not going to let you beat me up or, like, let you disrespect me. Like, I feel like that's not something that I'm going to allow to happen. And I think everybody deserves to be treated with dignity. And I think undocumented people, if anything, we haven't allowed undocumented people to express how heartbroken we are with this country and to express how disappointed we are with all these policies and these politicians who kept playing with us. We've been doing this since 2001. Like, you know, I'm over it. Like, I think right now what's happening when people call me and, you know, I see this rhetoric of like these DACA kids. I'm like, bruh, I'm about to be 30. Like, there's... I'm not a child. At some point I was, and I was hopeful, and I was like, listen, you know, they're fighting for me. And now that it's become clearly a football game, like, it's just, you know, at some point it's like, I don't believe the hype no more. Like, it's, it is what it is. Y'all are playing with people's lives, and, you know, God willing, all that energy that you're putting out, I'm sure, you know, the universe has a way to manifest it back. And whatever will happen, will happen. And at this point, as a 30-year-old man, I'm like, I need to be in control of my emotional well-being, my mental well-being, and really know that, you know, ultimately, all the tools that I need to survive and to make it in this country were granted by the people that raised me, and those being other undocumented people.
That's amazing. Well, you know, I follow you on social media, and you make me laugh so hard sometimes with things like, look at these full lips and tell me you're superior.
It's true. Some people be like, I'm genetically superior to you, but I'm like, how? You have no upper lip. That was shady. That's so shady. I'm taking back.
but you also make me reflect so much with things like, I want to know what home really means. And earlier in the conversation, you said that when you were in Mexico, you had this longing to come back home, and like that was LA. And I just want to ask you, do you feel like this is home? That America is home?
I think the people who are here create a sense of home for me. I think it's just, you know, when I'm having those potluck with my friends or like laughing, because we laugh about being undocumented. I think being undocumented should be a sitcom. It's super hilarious. All the situations you get yourself into, and you're like, okay, I gotta be quick with it and get out of this situation. But I think with me, it's the people. If anything, it's the people that if I were to, you know, return back, whatever happens, you know, whatever, you know, the future holds, I think it would be the people that I would mostly miss, you know, like being able to call somebody or like, hey, girl, let's go do this. And I think that is what I would miss. But I think, yeah, in a way, definitely here, because this is all I've known. And, you know, I went to Mexico and I've heard about so many stories, watched so many old VHS tapes about where I'm from. But at the same time, it's not the same, because I feel like the way that my grandma and my grandpa told me stories about Mexico was also this really romantic idea of what it was. And when I went there and I saw the little house, that she was like, oh my God, we have a house. It's amazing. Like, you're going to go back and you're going to live there. And I saw the house and I was like, this cannot be what you want to return to, you know. And me feeling like a snobby American, because I was like, you know, I can't really tell her that, you know. So,
So like my mom, I think, you know, she was in the U.S. for a long time. Now she's in Mexico. If you follow me on social media, you've probably have followed all this like intense back and forth that my mom has had about coming back to the U.S. But I think she has a very romantic idea of what America is, right? Like, she hasn't lived here for now going on 12, 13 years, and she still has this like longing to come back to America. I mean, she loves this place so much that she'll be like, mija, even bacon tastes better in America. I'm like, mom, you're a pescatarian when you eat bacon. But I think that when you leave a place for such a long time, you sort of only remember the good things.
Yeah.
Like, you only remember what's good about it. Like, my mom only remembers what's good about in America. And sometimes I want to be more like my mom. Like, I want to keep some hope. Like, I want to keep, you know, I actually, like, really love this country. And that actually sometimes gets me in trouble with, like, some people, because they're like, how can you love America? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, America has done so many, like, disastrous things. And I'm like, yeah, it has. Like, you can't shy away from the things we've done as a country to be the country that we are. And at the same time, I still think this is one of the few places on earth where, like, I can go from being undocumented to working on Wall Street to writing books to having this conversation with you. And you know, that's why I do love this country. One of the things that I love about your work and the things that you have done was this series that you did on DocuJoy. And so I just want you to tell me, why was it so important for you to show the joy that undocumented people still have in their lives?
So for me, when I did that project, my audience was undocumented people. I was like, I want to do a video, a poem in which I'm only undocumented people can relate to it, and I don't have to explain. Because they were like, the other thing about being undocumented, it's always like an educational burden. Like, I have to tell you, like, oh, I came here when I was 3. I have to tell you what DACA is. I have to tell you all these things. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. So I just want to showcase undocumented people smiling. Like, can we do that? Can we have, instead of showing our pain and our trauma, like, instead of asking undocumented people, are you scared to be undocumented? I don't want to answer that. You know, the answer is obvious.
Right.
So I'm going to ask you, what brings you joy? In what moment do you feel like a full human? And we did that. We wrote a poem. We shot all these amazing undocumented people riding bikes, skateboarding, like, you know, playing with their dogs, you know, dancing, surfing. I don't know, undocumented people surf, you know, like all these really emotional, tender moments. And for me, that's what gave me a little, like, you know, and that a lot of people have been using, like, yo, I've never really seen somebody that's really focusing on that. And I think right now, because everything's so gloomy, I think there's a movement for people to do more joyful things. You have the Black Joy Project that's documenting joyful moments in the Black communities. And I think people want that kind of reassurance or a little bit of hope. And I know it's not like, you know, it might be like a band-aid or whatever, but at some point we need to let people breathe. And that's what I want to do, create spaces where undocumented people don't have to explain anything. You don't have to tell me your sad migration. I don't really want to know how you crossed the border, girl. Just like what makes you human and at what moment, you know, what makes you smile. So yeah, that's the basics.
I love that. Well, I always ask every guest when I do a crooked conversation, what gives them hope? Because I always like to end on a good, happy note. So what gives you hope?
What gives me hope right now is just people in general. I think I've been a lot of amazing people that I've met through my poetry. And again, I'm like, oh, I've been so lucky, you know, but, you know,
I've
worked hard. But a lot of amazing students and people that write to me, they're like, listen, I really love your work. I think it's more people encourage me and believe more in me than I believe in myself. And that's what has helped me kind of keep going. Because, you know, I could just be chilling at home, but I'm like, no, I have to represent for my folks and really be out here a dignified immigrant because no one's going to disrespect us.
Yeah. I usually end on that hope question, but I just think the audience needs to, and would bring them so much joy to hear some of your work. So if you have a short poem that you can share with us, I would love to share it with our crooked audience.
I wrote a poem. This poem I wrote, and it's titled A Poem So the Weight of This Country Does Not Crush You. And it goes like this. Some days you may wake up sad. Some days you may wake up frustrated. Some days you may wake up tired. Some days you may wonder if it's worth it. Some days you may question your own growth. Some days you may think how immense the world is to be caged in this country, to be subjugated to this abuse. Some days you just want to breathe, and baby, I'm here to remind you to sit in those moments, sit in that whirlpool, but just know there are people like me picking up the load when you can't. There are people like me pushing so the weight of this country does not crush you. There are people like you who will fight when I can't, and we will take turns pushing against these walls. I got your back, and in the scheme of things, does anything else matter? Even if our fight is unfruitful, we will depart with our dignity intact. We'll depart knowing that this country is losing a prized possession. This country is losing the gift of our resilience. We will watch them as they tear into each other's skins and thank the heavens we never turn into beasts like them.
I love that. Thank you so much,
Izzy. Thank you so much.
And just lastly, where can people find you? Where can we see more of your work?
Yeah, so my website, yosimarreyes.com, and I actually having a show, my one-man show workshop performance called Prieto, July 12th to the 14th at Company of Angels Theater. So check that out here in Los Angeles. Yes.
Great. Awesome. Thank you so much. This was great.
Thank you. God bless America.
Okay, that was so beautiful. That poem really is going to keep me going for the rest of the summer, I think. And just before I close off, I want to take a moment of privilege and tell you about my new book called Someone Like Me. It's going to be out September 18th. You can pre-order it now. The book tells my story of coming to the U.S. It spans some time when I was a child in Mexico, separated from my parents. And as we're talking about family separation at the border, I just want to share that family separation doesn't just happen at the border. It happens in the interior of the U.S. It happens to parents who have to leave their kids behind in their home country so that they can provide for them. That's part of my story, and I hope you will pre-order my book and read more about it. Thank you so much for joining us. Make sure to rate Crooked Conversations. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. My handle is at Julissa Arce. Stay blessed and see you next week.
It's one thing falling in love with a house, picturing yourself moving in and calling it home, and quite another navigating the world of price negotiating, mortgage lenders, and finding the budget that works best for you. An agent who's a realtor can make understanding that world easier. Realtors have the expertise, access to proprietary data, and tools to help you get from imagining living somewhere to actually doing it. That's the kind of help we can provide. Because that's who we are. Realtors are members of the National Association of Realtors.